session. We have a very, very interesting session coming up now, and two excellent speakers for it. So we're with that fantastic background now in terms of existing consumer research, we're now going to turn our attention to specific areas of tremendous interest to the consumer policy field in general. And in particular, now we're going to zero in on the sharing and collaborative economy and new incentives, roles, and modalities in that regard. And we have two really well-positioned presenters on that topic, and each is going to speak for about 20 minutes apiece. First of all, we're going to have Sunil Johal from the Mowat Center speak, and Sunil Johal, just turning to the information here, Sunil Johal is the policy director at the Mowat Center at the University of Toronto, and frequently is invited to talk and speak on these issues in a lot of different media sources. And prior to that, he was the director with the Ontario Ministry of Economic Development and Innovation, and has had senior management and policy roles with the Ontario Cabinet Office and various other ministries, and holds degrees from LSE, Osgoode Hall Law School, and the University of Western Ontario. And in addition to someone speaking kind of coming from a pure public policy kind of a background, we have someone else speaking on from a different perspective, and that's Ted Graham, coming from PwC. And let me just see, here we are. So Ted is the innovation leader at PwC Canada, where he helps to turn ideas into invoices. And is the author of a forthcoming book, The Uber of Everything, and is also founder of the South Core Innovation Hub. I'm indebted to Howard in the audience here, Howard Dean from Consumer Council of Canada, for first alerting me to the writings of Ted. I saw some LinkedIn posts that he did on it, which are very interesting. So I'm sure we're set up for different perspectives on an issue that continues to stimulate interesting discussions over supper and otherwise on a very interesting area. So without further ado, I'm going to pass things on. Who's going to speak first? There we go. Okay, Sunil, take it away.
Thanks. I think I have a mic. Sorry.
Oh, you got a mic? Well, that might take
So, good morning, everybody. I'll come out. I feel like I'm a bit caged in there, so I'll come out. And I didn't realize I could send all my invoices to Ted, so I was buying some expensive breakfast, so instead of shirk paying for them, I might send that over to Ted. So good morning. Hope everybody's doing well. I'm glad Matthew actually only had 10 minutes, because he was starting to encroach quite significantly onto what I was going to talk about, so that's very good. So the Mowat Center is an independent policy think tank, public policy think tank at the University of Toronto. Some of you may have heard of it. If you haven't, we have two main areas of focus. So one is intergovernmental affairs research, particularly from Ontario's perspective. So how is Ontario treated within the Federation by the federal government? Long story short, not particularly well. The second area of research is government transformation. So this is the area that the sharing economy research falls under. So we put out a report back in February called Policymaking for the Sharing Economy. It's available on our website if you'd like to take a look at it. And we thought that this would be something that there would be a good amount of public and policymaker interest in, but we were actually quite surprised by how much interest there was. So this is the kind of issue that's it's always in the media. It's something governments are always talking about. So our paper was really an attempt to kind of grapple with some of the issues, frame them in a way that are accessible, that makes sense for regulators, so that as we're talking about companies like Uber and Airbnb, how do we actually regulate these companies in a fair way that recognizes that we have existing companies that are already in this space and that in many cases are very over-regulated, and that there's really a big discrepancy between the playing fields between these new market entrants and the existing market entrance. And then we've obviously got all of the consumer issues, which we'll delve into and which are probably the interest of most of you here. So we'll hopefully get into most of those today. So we've done some other work in the past few months. We helped KPMG, sorry, Ted, on the City of Ottawa taxi review. We're putting out a chapter for the OECD in probably February on the sharing economy and what it means for the tourism sector. So that'll be building on our existing report. as well. Then we're doing a number of consulting reports for government agencies that are curious about what will this mean for them in the coming years. So Matthew already covered some of this, so I'll just keep this very brief in terms of what is the sharing economy, how do we define it. I mean, essentially we're talking about technological marketplaces and platforms that allow people to connect directly with each other to transact goods and services. So we had a question about peer-to-peer kind of consumers as competitors. That's really what we're talking about. So instead of me going to Walmart and buying something, I can go to Matthew and buy something, although Matthew probably doesn't have as much selection as Walmart, but maybe you have a higher quality.
You're welcome to any of those.
Great. Great. Yeah, much quicker. So that's really, in essence, what we're talking about. So consumers interacting directly with each other for goods. So if we're talking about something like Etsy, I can make a sweater and I can sell it to somebody, or I can make a purse or a wallet and sell it to somebody, or for services. So I can give somebody a ride in my car. I can actually, in some cases, this is bigger in the States right now than it is in Canada, but I can actually say, hey, do you need somebody to shovel your driveway? I can come around and do that. Although I did just see in the paper a couple weeks ago there's a new plow service that somebody's hoping to create a sharing economy platform. So plow drivers who aren't fully utilizing their plows can access people who need their driveways plowed. And then the other model, which is not quite as probably ubiquitous right now, is that we share the same asset on a time rental basis, so like a Bixi bike or something like that. So a company actually owns the asset, but they are renting it out on a time usage basis to different consumers. But essentially there are a couple of things I wanted to talk about here in terms of this space. So obviously Uber and Airbnb are the companies that get all of the attention. They're the ones everybody talks about. But there are many, many other companies in the sharing economy space. So this is a little small, but it gives you a sense of, in transportation, we've also got companies like Lyft. We have car sharing companies like Zipcar. In the retail space, you've got Etsy, you've got eBay, you've got Craigslist. Accommodation, Airbnb is the big one, but there's also VRBO, Vacation Rental by Owner, where if I have a spare room in my house and I want to let it out to somebody, I can do that. And then the services side, which is, I think that's the, really the interesting space in the years to come, where I think you could see a huge explosion in a service oriented economy like Canada, and people kind of looking to supplement income and people looking for kind of on-demand workforce. How is that going to kind of revolutionize our economy in the years to come? And then on the finance side, I mean, I think a couple of people have already mentioned Kickstarter, so if you're looking for equity to start a restaurant or something, that's a good way to do that. So these five sectors alone are worth $15 billion globally right now, according to a study done by PwC. They're expected to grow to $335 billion within 10 years, so more than a 20-fold increase within 10 years. So these things are growing very, very quickly. So is this really new? That's a question that people ask a lot. And fundamentally, not really. The issue of me selling something to my neighbor or helping my neighbor out with something has always been happening. I think you could argue, though, that as social bonds have frayed and people don't know their neighbors as well, particularly as kind of urbanization has taken pace very rapidly in the past 30 or 40 years, that maybe I don't know my neighbors as well as I might have known them 50 or 60 or 70 years ago when my community was a bit small. So the concept isn't new. People have always been trading things with each other, or kind of going through the informal or underground economy. The scale is what's really new here. The technology enables me to connect very directly with many, many people in Toronto or in Montreal, not just the 10 or 20 or 30 people that I know fairly well in my social network. And the technology allows this to be very frictionless. It's very easy for me to just pick up my smartphone and call an Uber car. I don't have to pick up a phone. I don't have to wait on hold. I can see where the car is. It's a GPS-tracked car, so if I'm on a cold day in Montreal waiting for a cab to show up, I don't have to go and stand on the street and look for the cab. I can look on my phone, sit in my office, and then as soon as the cab's pulling in, I can just pop right out and get the cab. And then the third point that's really important is it's very easy for these companies to expand very rapidly because they have zero capital expenditures. Airbnb doesn't own a single hotel room, yet is worth more than many of the most of the major, if not all of the major hotel chains that you're very familiar with. They're leveraging existing assets that are being underutilized by people. And that's a key point when you talk about the sharing economy, is underutilized assets. How do we maximize the value of assets that already exist out there? And the same thing with a company like Uber or Lyft on the ride-sharing side. They don't own any cars, so that's a very fundamentally easy way for them to expand into new markets. They just have to kind of set up their app and say, now we're going to move to Edmonton, or now we're going to move to Calgary. So the primary barrier to entry for these companies is regulatory, not capital. They're not having to buy cars when they move to Edmonton. They're just going to have to make sure, and they've had mixed success on this, that they're legally able to operate in new cities that they are setting up. So in terms of the speed and scale of growth, I mean, this slide just gives you a little bit of a sense of how quickly these companies are growing. So that chart basically shows how many people have stayed in Airbnb accommodation over a five-year period. So in summer of 2010, it was less than 50,000 rooms being rented. This past summer, 17 million rooms being rented. So 350-fold increase within 5 years. Uber adds 40,000 new drivers every single month in the United States. I mean, and I could just kind of keep listing stats off at you, but the basic point is these companies grow very, very quickly. People like them. They find them easy to use. If you look at consumer survey, so Toronto did one around Uber, 65% of people have a positive impression of Uber, contrasted with 29% having a positive impression of taxi companies. And those kind of statistics are fairly common if you look at Airbnb as well. People find that they have a much more authentic experience. If you're going to stay in a new place on a vacation, I'm actually maybe getting to know a local person. I'm not just kind of checking into a nameless, faceless hotel. I'm actually staying in a real neighborhood, and that's a very different experience that people quite enjoy. And then the valuation of these companies is just absolutely astronomical. Uber, when we wrote our paper, I think Uber is worth around $20 billion in February. It's $50 or $60 billion now. I mean, every month it's kind of going up. So as we do presentations, like, okay, how many more billion do we add to Uber's valuation? So who are some of the key players in this space? That's really important to think about when you're thinking about these issues from a public policy perspective, because we have a tendency to just kind of think of kind of the one or two key players, like what does this mean for Uber, what does this mean for existing cab companies? But there are a lot of other players in the space that we need to think through. What are their interests? What are their perspectives? I mean, we've obviously got the established operators, so the hotel chains, the cab drivers, the cab companies. Generally speaking, I would say their perspective is, let's restrict market access. We like how things are operating. We have maybe not a monopoly, but a quasi monopoly on some of these services. You've got the platform. So the companies like Uber, Airbnb, Etsy, their objective obviously is usually the opposite. How do we open up these markets? How do we gain access to consumers? And then we've got these. This is really where it becomes interesting, I think, because these are the people we don't often think about. You've got at the top entrepreneurs, the service workers, the providers. So the Uber driver, the Airbnb host, the Etsy artisan, the person who's selling their good service, what is their interest and what do they look like? And it's a very diverse set of people. Some people do this on a very supplementary basis. So a couple hours a week, 5 hours a week, they're driving an Uber. Maybe once a month they let out a room. Some people are doing this in a much more, though, comprehensive way. And if you look at the stats in terms of what percentage of people's income is derived from the sharing economy, it's really quite divided in terms of under 25% is about 30%, over 75% of their income is also about 25-30%. So it's very much a mixed bag of people. You can't really make a generalization. This is just part-timers. Some people are actually doing this on quite a full-time basis. Then you've got consumers and users. So as I mentioned, for the most part, they're very receptive and open to these types of platforms. They find that the goods are often cheaper. They're as good a quality, if not higher quality. And a key point I didn't really speak about, I think Matthew briefly mentioned this, the whole idea that we've got reputational rankings on these platforms is absolutely critical, because that's what gives me the trust to transact with somebody that I don't know. Because I can see how have all of the previous people who have used this service and driven with that particular Uber driver, and Ted will speak about this, I know, in some more, you know, how have they ranked that driver? So I know this is a five-star driver. I have no concerns. Okay, so my wife and we used VRBO this summer to rent a place outside of Kingston. She never would have usually been open to that, but she looked at the website and saw that this has like 15 reviews. They're all 5 stars. You can read what the other people are saying. She's like, oh, that sounds really good. Other people think it's good. So humans being social animals, if somebody else thinks something is good, we're going to try it. So that some people have referred to that as the second invisible hand of the marketplace. Those trust reputational rankings can give us some sense of security in this new world. And then we've got the broader public. So not everybody's necessarily engaged in these activities, but if I'm a resident of Montreal and Uber's coming and setting up shop in the city, I have an interest in safe roadways. If I'm walking down the street, I don't want 30 Uber drivers careening around the corner trying to pick up somebody if I'm just kind of making my way around town and going grocery shopping. So I have an interest in safe roads. If I'm not an Airbnb host, but my neighbor is, I didn't really sign up to live in a commercially zoned neighborhood. So if the guy next to me is renting out his house to 30 different people every month, that's probably a bit of a pain to me. I'm not necessarily going to like that. So you're seeing all kinds of issues where people who aren't even engaged in the space are affected by it. So how do we think of their interests as well? How much time do I have?
You're doing pretty good. I'm going to give you a flash when you get to 3 minutes.
Okay.
You're not there yet.
Great. So one other thing I wanted to talk about before we depart is, what are some of the other sectors that are ripe for disruption? I mean, we've seen what's happening in taxis, we've seen what's happening in accommodation, we're starting to see in financing. These are some of the criteria that we think are going to be important as we start future casting. I mean, I'm going to talk to the Bank of Montreal tomorrow, and they're very curious. What are the next sectors? Because they want to see where the market opportunities are. So as we were thinking about that, we drew together this list. So one, obviously, is, are there rentable or shareable assets? It could be a hard asset like a car. Could be a soft asset like my skills. I can write a research paper. That's actually my only skill, so I'm probably not going to do very well in the future sharing economy, because most people don't want a 20-page paper written. A lot of students would, actually. That's true. I might get in some trouble for writing my own students' papers, though. No. What about the types of industries? I mean, generally speaking, some type of consumer service industry where there's very little brand loyalty. It might be a fragmented marketplace, and there might be limited competition. Those are the types of sectors we might see people moving into next. I mentioned highly fragmented marketplace. Is there an economic win-win? So if I'm an Airbnb host, I'm making a little extra money from renting out my space, and the person who's staying with me is saving money because they're not going to the Holiday Inn down the street. So that's a win-win for both of us. So where can we see those other types of win-wins moving forward? And then network effects matter. So what we mean by that is it matters how many people are on your marketplace. If I'm looking to sign up as somebody who's going to use a ride-sharing platform, I'm going to go to the company that's got all the drivers, right? Because it'll be much easier for me to get a ride. If Uber has 100,000 drivers in Toronto and Lyft only has 100, it's likely I'm going to go to Uber because they'll be able to provide me a faster ride. I know that somebody will be there to pick me up within 3 or 4 minutes. If there's only 30 or 40 drivers on a platform, that's not as good. And conversely, if I'm somebody who wants to drive for Uber, I'm going to go where all the customers are. So what we'll start to see is a highly kind of accelerated growth of some of these platforms. It's kind of like when Google was starting out as a search engine. It didn't start off like you had Ask Jeeves and all these other things like Yahoo, but once one of them starts emerging, that's where everybody starts going in some way. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. But some of the sectors that we might see disrupted in the future could be things even like home care for the elderly. So it's something where we know there's going to be a growing demand for it. Are there opportunities for people to connect directly with people who need help at home in some way, for example? Or we could think about like tutoring or kind of there's dozens of potential opportunities where you can see these things moving forward. So from a governmental point of view, I mean, this was the title of our report, Going Beyond Whack-A-Mole, because governments essentially are just whacking away at these companies, not in a very disconnected manner. So how do we step back? Governments really need to step back and think about, from a principles-based point of view, what type of policy framework do we want? If we're talking about taxis, we probably want accessibility, we want safety, and we want competition. Everything else that we do to regulate is probably unnecessary in one way, shape, or form. If we can ensure those 3 or 4 key policy objectives, we should step back and let the market play itself out to some extent. So some things we're seeing governments around the world do are taking on a more performance-based regulation approach. So if a company or a service provider is a good actor, we can take a hands-off approach. If their ratings are bad or there are problems, that's where we want governments to intervene and say, hey, this isn't right. We can look at all of the data that these companies have. Uber's entered into agreements with Boston, for example, where they're in exchange for operating in the city, they give Boston access to a lot of their data. So Boston can then improve transit routes. It can see where there are kind of hot spots for lots of activity at certain times of night, and then it can refine its own municipal services. Reviewing existing regulations and revising them downwards where possible is also another important thing to do. So this is an opportunity to learn. The sharing economy is popular, and it's popular with consumers for a number of different reasons. I mean, it does harness data in a much more efficient and effective way, so people can see what's a good service, what's not a good service. You're maximizing the value of assets, and you're creating much more efficient marketplaces where I don't have to go through many, many intermediaries or middlemen to get something. I can deal directly with somebody else to do that. So what it means is we're going to shift away in many ways from an ownership model where I have to own an asset to really take advantage of it. I can rent or I can share, and I can otherwise use assets as I move forward. So that's my talk, and then I know Ted will...